back. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway. In some states around the country, including Louisiana, students heading back to the classroom will be greeted with a slogan we've all heard before, "In God We Trust."
So it's not just Louisiana, it's 11 states across the country have mandated that the national motto, "In God We Trust," be displayed somehow on the walls of public schools.
That's Patrick Hornbeck, a scholar of religion and law and chair of Fordham University's theology department.
The Louisiana bill in particular, which just took effect, says, well, there's already a sort of civics curriculum and students are supposed to be taught about the flag and national traditions, but now it mandates explicitly that students be taught about the motto.
And as you might imagine, the requiring of any religious display, however innocuous, is sure to cause controversy in what's supposed to be a secular space. The emphasis on the national motto, "In God We Trust," and its usage elsewhere in U.S. civic tradition pushes up against our country's shifting cultural norms and the legal limits of religious speech in public schools.
Many of us, I think, are accustomed to thinking about "In God We Trust" as this long, long-standing historical thing, whereas it's actually from the 1950s. The U.S. Congress adopts it in the 1950s around the same time that the phrase "under God" was added to the Pledge of Allegiance. This is a time of anti-communist panic. It's a time, maybe we might say, of concern about atheism, which was connected to communism. The saying goes back to the Civil War. And so Union coins had the phrase "In God We Trust" on them. But it got repurposed in the middle of the 20th century in support of what we would probably think of today as a kind of Christian nationalism. And it seems that the organizations that are behind encouraging state legislatures to pass these kinds of bills have maybe something like that kind of vision in common as well.
You mentioned the Pledge of Allegiance, and I remember being a little girl and having to put my hand on my heart and pledge to allegiance and say those words, "under God, indivisible." Shouldn't there be, I mean, is there a separation of church and state here? And if so, how do we explain this conflict? Are these laws legal?
Well, Tanzina, you've put your finger on exactly the nub of this question. And I think that whether it's about memorials in the shape of crosses or flags or school prayer, this is a debate that the U.S. and the U.S. court system has been grappling with for decades. Many folks think that the Constitution includes a promise of separation of church and state. And that's actually not true. The Constitution itself only says that Congress can't pass laws respecting the establishment of religion or prohibiting its free exercise. But it wasn't until about 12 years later that Thomas Jefferson wrote a very famous letter soon after taking office as president to a Baptist church up in Connecticut. And it's in that letter that he coined the phrase "wall of separation between church and state." And even then, that doesn't really quite define what we mean. So there's lots of people who believe that the U.S. needs, especially in light of our recent history, to move towards a much more secular approach, maybe something like what Western European countries have. Other folks say, well, the use of Judeo-Christian language and symbolism has been part of our traditions for centuries. And others want to actually go one step farther and say the U.S. is, was, should be a Christian country, whatever that might happen to mean.
When I bring it back again to the Pledge of Allegiance, children can essentially opt out. Mm-hmm. They can choose not to put their hand on their heart. They can choose not to recite. This doesn't really give children an option to opt out.
I think one of the best stories that I've read comes from Kentucky, where one of the schools that was affected by one of these laws decided to fulfill its requirements by posting a framed $1 bill on the wall of the classroom. And you know, if you pull out your $1 bill out of your pocket, it does in fact say, "In God We Trust." But I suppose the question that I would want to ask is, you know, in this long-term conversation about how much religion is appropriate in civil, secular spaces, once there's a sort of toe in the door here, could not a really zealous school district decide that they want 10-foot graven plaques in every classroom? And that would, I imagine, be a real challenge for lots of folks who don't identify with the Judeo-Christian traditions.
Is this a response potentially to the changing demographics of the United States? And I don't just mean the changing racial demographics, but also the changing faith demographics in many ways.
That's a great question. And the fastest growing religious group in the U.S. are unaffiliated people. So 30% of those under 35, for instance. And that was hardly the case in the 1950s when these laws were passed. I don't want to make too much of this connection, but there's an analogy to be drawn. In the 50s, many U.S. leaders, lawmakers in particular, were very concerned about shoring up the U.S. as a Christian country, not unlike how in the late 19th, early 20th centuries, a lot of southern states were really interested in shoring up their identity with, for instance, Confederate war memorials, which we've been talking about so much in the course of the last few years. And so it seems to me that one thing that might be in common here is that when a group that has been dominant feels threatened, one of the things that it might want to do is to find markers of showing we're still here, we're still the dominant option. Do I think that the 11 states concerned were deficient in providing their students with civics education? Well, I don't know, but I can't imagine that that's the case. There's something else going on with this legislation, which seems to be directed by a number of special interest groups that are concerned about maintaining what they see as the U.S.'s Christian identity.
This being the United States, one thing that we enjoy doing is litigating, and I can't imagine that there won't be cases taken up against these laws. Do you have any sense of how judiciaries might consider challenges to the legalities of these laws?
There's no single approach that justices, even on the U.S. Supreme Court, take in these particular cases. There's a classic case from the 1970s that said that the test for determining if government action involving religion is valid is you find out, does it have a legitimate secular purpose? Does it favor any particular religion over any other one? And does it serve a compelling state interest? And people defending these particular laws would be able to say, well, there is a secular purpose. This is about teaching children about the customs and the history of the country, and the motto has been adopted by the U.S. Congress, and so students should learn about that. It seems to me that the folks who wrote these bills did so in a way that would insulate them from challenges. Now, I think the place where challenges could come is you have a particularly zealous school district who wants to go well beyond what the bill requires. And parents or students could bring what we would call as-applied challenges. The bill itself is probably okay, but the way it's being implemented violates someone's rights.
Patrick Hornbeck is a scholar of religion and law, and he's also the chair of Fordham University's theology department. Patrick, thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.